Headlines this hour. Iran's leader says countries can turn sanctions into a tool of empowerment by tapping into their national capacities. Iran says it is high time the U.S. made its decision in response to Tehran's initiatives on the revival of the 2015 deal. Also, oil prices jumped after European Union leaders reached an agreement to ban 90% of Russian crude by the end of the year. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says world powers are weaponizing sanctions against other countries, but such bans can be crippled by focusing on domestic powers and capacities. In a Monday meeting with the visiting Tajik president, Ayatollah Sayyidali Khamenei said that Iran has made good progress in various fields, not just despite, but also because of Western coercive measures. The leader said that Tehran and Dushanbe can expand their ties much further than the current level, and that relations must undergo fundamental transformation. Elsewhere, Ayatollah Khamenei called for the formation of an inclusive government in Afghanistan, stressing that Iran and Tajikistan are both concerned about the spread of terrorism and Takfiri groups in the region. For his part, El-Mali Rahman also called for the improvement of Iran-Tajikistan ties. He said that his country seeks peace and stability in Afghanistan, ruled by a government with the participation of all ethnicities. University professor Fouad Izadi says Iran's leader is sending a message of resilience to the U.S. by downplaying the impact of sanctions amid talks to revive the 2015 deal.
Well, I think the section of Ayatollah Khamenei's speech on sanctions had two purposes. One, it's customary for world leaders, when they meet, they share experiences, both positive experiences, negative experiences. So this is an achievement of Iran to be able to grow become a leader in many scientific fields at the same time that the country has been under sanctions. So that's the number one reason. It's an ordinary thing to do. I think the second reason Ayatollah Khamenei talked about sanctions is with regard to what's going on with JCPOA. As you know, the United States government, the Biden administration, is basically following the Trump lead when it comes to Iran. Biden is basically implementing Trump's policies, and the negotiations are not going fast anywhere. So the message, I think, the second reason this issue is raised is to give this idea to the other side, that Iran can live with sanctions, and Iran has been able to overcome difficulties. And the basic message is that even if the United States wants to continue that policy of sanctioning Iran, it may actually have some benefits in the long run for the country.
Iran says the latest reports by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency on its nuclear activities are unbalanced and unfair. According to the Foreign Ministry spokesman, Said Khatibzadeh, the reports repeat the same errors that existed in the Director General's briefing to the European Parliament. He added that even the agency has admitted to those flaws before. Khatibzadeh urged the IAEA to avoid politicizing its reports under pressure from Israel and other parties. He also talked about efforts to revive the 2015 Iran deal, adding everything now hinges on the U.S. making the right decision.
The United States has unfortunately failed so far to give the required response. If the U.S. stops hesitating in its words and actions and moves toward making a political decision, there will be no impasse in the talks, and the small but outstanding issues in the agreement can be finalized. The current pause in the negotiations is because of U.S. failure to respond to the initiatives put forth by Iran and the European side.
Khatibzadeh added that what Iran needs more than anything now is guarantees that it will economically benefit from any agreement. He said other details, including the U.S. blacklisting of the IRGC, will have to be decided at the negotiating table. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has released footage showing the seizure of two Greek tankers in the Persian Gulf over maritime violations. The video shows the IRGC Hellebore special forces boarding and taking control of the Greek ships. The vessels were impounded on Friday. Shipping sources said one tanker was carrying an oil cargo bound for the U.S., while the other was heading for Greece. The incident came days after Greece impounded an Iranian-flagged oil tanker and delivered its cargo to the U.S. The Iranian Foreign Ministry summoned the Swiss and Greek envoys over the issue. Switzerland represents U.S. interests in Iran. The ministry slammed the U.S. violation of international law and maritime conventions governing free navigation and trade. It also demanded the immediate release of the seized ship and its cargo. Oil prices are seeing a rise over the European Union's decision to cut two-thirds of Russia's oil imports into the bloc. In early deals, Brent crude reached a two-month high of $122, while U.S. West Texas Intermediate reached $118 per barrel. EU leaders have agreed to ban oil imports from Russia by as much as 90% by the end of this year. The embargo affects Russian oil imports via sea, but pipeline deliveries will be exempted. The continued pipeline purchases is meant to allow Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic more time to trim Russian supplies. The embargo is part of the sixth package of EU sanctions on Moscow since the beginning of the Ukraine war. Germany is going to build up Europe's largest conventional army within NATO in the near future. Chancellor Olaf Scholz made the announcement after the government and conservative opposition agreed to a $107 billion fund to modernize the army. According to Scholz, the agreement will considerably strengthen the security of Germany and its NATO allies. The agreement will also allow Berlin to achieve NATO's target of spending 2% of GDP on defense. NATO's European members have been increasing their defense spending since the war in Ukraine started in late February. People in Gaza have protested to drum up support for thousands of Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails, especially administrative detainees. Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say that they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes. Ashraf Shannon has more on this report.
Families of prisoners and their advocates staged a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in the blockaded Gaza Strip. Their action was in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and detention centers, including more than 500 administrative detainees. Palestinian administrative detainees have been boycotting Israeli regime courts for more than 5 months to protest their administrative detention. Administrative detention is incarceration without trial or charge and has no time limit.
Administrative detainees are subjected to extreme suffering inside Israeli jails. They've been boycotting Israeli courts for more than 150 days to protest the detention without charge. Administrative detention is a racist policy and only causes pain and suffering to Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are being denied basic rights. Since the beginning of this year, Israeli regime forces have arrested some 3,000 Palestinians, including children and women.
Administrative detention is a systematic policy by the Israeli regime to hold Palestinian prisoners behind bars without trial for a very long time. Administrative detention can be renewed indefinitely, and it inflicts psychological pressure on the prisoners. We have all suffered from administrative detention inside Israeli jails.
During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Ministry of Detainees Affairs slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
We call on all international human rights organizations to come out of their silence and exert pressure on the Israeli regime to stop the inhumane administrative detention policy. Palestinian prisoners are freedom fighters and must be treated according to international laws and norms. The Israeli regime is violating conventions regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world keeps turning a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
According to Palestinian prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Most of these detainees have been held with no charge or trial. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
Israel and the United Arab Emirates can now cooperate under a free trade agreement as part of joint efforts to upgrade their level of ties. Under the deal signed earlier today, tariffs would be removed on most products exchanged between the two sides. The agreement is the regime's first big trade accord with an Arab state following its normalization with several countries in the region. Back in 2020, the UAE, Bahrain, and Morocco normalized ties with the Israeli regime under the so-called Abraham Accords that was mediated by the United States. Palestinians who have been suffering under Israeli occupation for decades are opposed to the deal for undermining their cause. Iran has also repeatedly warned the Emirati officials of the threat that Israel's presence poses to security in the Persian Gulf region. Veteran Lebanese politician Nabih Berri is re-elected as the Speaker of Lebanon's parliament. This will be Berri's seventh term in office. He is the leader of the Amal movement and a supporter of Hezbollah resistance movement. The new parliament started work after a vote on May 15. The election was the first since the devastating blast in Beirut port in 2020 and Lebanon's economic collapse. The crisis is the gravest threat to Lebanon's stability since the 15-year civil war ended in 1990. The UN has warned that 1.1 million Afghan children under the age of 5 will likely face the most severe form of malnutrition this year. It comes as increasing numbers of hungry children flow into hospital wards. Rahmatullah Bhagwan has more from Kabul.
The UN bodies warn that factors connected to malnutrition in Afghanistan are going up every month. Millions are struggling with poverty and hunger, and thousands of others are going unemployed. Rising prices are adding to the difficulties of families to provide food.
All these 200 people are unemployed, including me. We have to pay for our houses' rents, treatment and medications, and provide food for our families. I have a family of 10. We can't afford flour, oil or rice due to soaring prices. Most of us can't even have a single meal per day. We should have jobs or receive relief funds.
With the given situation, UNICEF warns that 1.1 million Afghan children are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition this year. Officials at the Indira Gandhi Children's Hospital said that the number of malnourished children in Afghanistan is rapidly increasing, and urgent action is needed to avert the catastrophe.
The increasing number of children at risk of malnutrition is published, which is more than 1 million. What should be done? I urge the UN and international bodies to help Afghans avert this disaster. I hope they consider us as a member of the international community and give us our rights. In particular, we need them to free our frozen funds and separate the health sector from politics.
Due to poverty, most Afghan mothers do not have proper nutrition during pregnancy. Neither can afford enough after birth.
I used to give my child some bread and tea. I was unable to breastfeed her because we couldn't afford food for ourselves. We are coming from poor families. Her father is left jobless at home. My child was constantly losing weight and cried a lot. I knew it was all because of hunger, so I brought her here.
After the Taliban seized power in August 2021, the U.S. and its allies froze about $9 billion in Afghan assets and cut off international funding. This move has partly crippled a system that was already dependent on aid. Malnutrition is a threat to children across Afghanistan. This as the country is suffering from the shortage of medicines, with hospitals being overwhelmed by hungry babies and mothers. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Campaigners are threatening legal action if Britain's Home Office fails to make public a damning report that claims 30 years of racist immigration laws caused the Windrush scandal. The 52-page document is set to conclude that British immigration legislation is designed to reduce the country's non-white population. There are fears that another Windrush-type scandal is inevitable unless there's immediate action. Mina Taylor has the details.
An on-release report commissioned by the UK's Home Office lays the blame for the Windrush scandal, which saw hundreds of citizens from the Commonwealth wrongly detained, denied legal rights and in some cases deported from the UK, squarely at the feet of unjust laws that deliberately target people from minority ethnic backgrounds. Officials have so far refused to make the report public, much to the ire of lawyers like Jacqueline McKenzie, who represents a sizable number of Windrush victims. She's threatening to challenge the Home Office on behalf of her clients.
We all have a right to know what's in this report. Why is it a secret? It's predicated on a need to establish what caused the Windrush scandal, to make sure that we never go there again, and also to right the wrongs. And if we can't see it, then it suggests something very sinister is going on.
The Home Office says it's making progress to becoming an open and compassionate organization. But for those who have to deal with the fallout of their racist legislation, they're finding it hard to reconcile that statement with their own experiences.
We've got to this position after 30, 40 years of racist immigration policy, building one on top of the other, until the point now where we probably have the most discriminatory and draconian racist immigration legislation anywhere outside of Israel.
Despite thousands coming to settle from former British colonies, immigration laws, it seemed, favoured a certain type of immigrant, a trend that continues into today with the announcement that the UK will fast-track graduates from the top 50 universities, none of them in Africa, the Caribbean, or Latin America.
We see that privileges were given to other groups of people, particularly people from what was described as the old Commonwealths. And effectively, there was going to be white people from Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and white South Africans, you know. So racist ideology has always underpinned this. Remember when the Windrush boat itself was outside the Tilbury docks, a Labour Prime Minister, Clement Attlee, was actually considering sending that boat around. Remember, that's the 22nd of June 1948.
Things are set to get worse.
Secretary now has the power to strip you of your citizenship, whether you're British-born or not, and have you summarily shipped out the country. So not only are they not fixing all that was wrong with Windrush, they are actually giving themselves more power to commit more of the similar sorts of abuses without being in contrary of the law.
Hopefully forcing the Home Office to publish the so far secretive report will lay bare Britain's immigration practices for all to see. This in the hope that deep scrutiny means there can be no further repeats. Amina Taylor, London.
And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the present and future of Albania in a conversation with Albanian historian and author Olsi Yazici. But first, this brief analysis.
Albania is a small country we rarely hear about in the news. One of the reasons for this is that the US decided to turn this southern Balkan state on the Adriatic coast into a base of operations against Russia and Muslim countries such as Iran and Turkey in the early 2000s. Beyond its geographic location, it is the fact that Albania is the only Muslim-majority nation in Europe, with approximately 70% of the population adhering to Islam, that made it a target for US domination. Following the collapse of communism in the 1990s, the US aggressively expanded its strategic presence into Eastern Europe and the Balkans, including into Albania. Albania had been ruled by the communist dictator Enver Hoxha for decades, who proclaimed Albania to be the first officially atheist state in the world, and who actively persecuted all religious activity. Despite this severe repression, Hoxha was not successful in extinguishing the religious beliefs of the Albanians, particularly the Muslim population. After the collapse of communist rule, Albanians revived religious life and re-established connections with their fellow Muslim brethren in the Muslim Ummah, particularly with Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. This caused an alarm in the United States and Europe, who feared the emergence of a majority Muslim country on the European continent, with close strategic relations with the mentioned Muslim nations. A strategic campaign was initiated by the United States and its vassals to first strategically deny Albania to the Muslim world and to once again de-Islamize Albania, this time by using the excuse of fighting terrorism to ban all contacts between official Albanian Muslim organizations with any Muslim organizations from Iran, Turkey, and Arab countries. After the failure of the US-backed and Emirati-financed coup d'etat in Turkey against President Erdogan, the religious affairs of the Sunni Muslims in Albania was handed over to the pro-US and pro-Zionist Gulenist cult headquartered in the US state of Pennsylvania, a cult which played a key role in the attempted coup d'etat in Turkey. All Albanian Muslim clerics who opposed the imposition of the Gulenist cult on their country were persecuted, imprisoned, or exiled. The US also forced the Albanian government to accept the permanent encampment of the remnants of the Rajavi terrorist cult on its soil, a cult responsible for the murder of over 17,000 people in Iran since the 1970s, a terrorist cult that the Iraqi government expelled after the end of Saddam's rule because of its crimes against the Iraqi people during that era. Albania was forced to accept them after literally no other country in the world would accept them on their soil. The US strategic campaign for Albania also weaponized the legitimate feelings of Albanians and the Albanian majority population in neighboring Kosovo to turn that region into a base against Serbia and Russia. In pursuit of these strategies, the United States, through its embassy and through organizations such as the Soros Foundation, has captured and bought the Albanian political leadership, similar to the fashion it bought and captured elites in countries such as Ukraine. This puppet elite is committing the same crimes and abuses that other US-backed elites in other Muslim nations are committing, with the same result of turning the people against anyone and anything related to America. It appears the Albanian people are beginning to resist this US diktat, and will eventually replace the current leadership controlled by the US with leaders who will re-establish relations with important Muslim nations in accordance with Albania's real national interests and the deep-held religious beliefs of its people.
Dr. Yazici, thank you so much for joining us. You know, there's not many programs done on Albania.
It's a relatively small country. It's one that maybe the big news organizations might not want to spend a lot of time on. It is also one of those countries which is very interestingly completely dominated by the West. A lot of stories going on there that if it was in any other country, it would be headline news. And yet we see that absolutely nothing is talked about it. Please explain to us, because we have an actual terrorist cult organization now that is in Albania. Again, for us in Iran, very important, because they killed 17,000 people in Iran, which is the Rajavi cult that used to be in Iraq. And when the Saddam regime was overthrown by the U.S., they end up in Albania. How did that happen? If you could give us a little background on them coming to Albania. And by the way, sorry, doctor, we have to also mention a lot of these people are brainwashed, because what ended up happening is a lot of them, when they got off the plane or when they were when they arrived in Albania, they actually defected. They ran away because it was the first time that they were allowed to leave that encampment that they had lived in for decades in Iraq. They weren't even allowed to leave that encampment in Iraq during the decades that they lived there. So the minute they got off the plane or the minute they entered Albania, approximately half of them, this is what the media was reporting, approximately half of them actually fled from that cult and sought asylum in different parts of Europe.
Yeah, you are correct. Rajavi cult was brought in Albania. They started to come since 2013. At first, the Americans brought them to Albania under the excuse that they had to bring only some of their leaders, but then the bulk of this cult was brought under the Obama administration, and it was the Secretary of State John Kerry who came to Albania and brought 3,000 of them. The Americans had big problem with Iraq, because Iraqis knew very well who the Rajavi cult were, and they have committed many crimes against the people of Iraq.
That's
and
right.
They were looking for a safe haven for these terrorists. They tried to send these terrorists in many countries. They approached Macedonia, Romania, probably even Ukraine. But many countries of Eastern Europe simply refused to host these terrorists. So they brought them to Albania. Now, the question that many international scholars ask is, why Albania? The reason is simple. The Albanian government is a mafia government. For people who know local Albanian politics, most of our politicians, we have even government ministers, are drug dealers and who involve themselves in drug trafficking. So
you're saying that the organized crime is interwoven with the government there. There's not a line between organized crime and the government. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, in this moment that we are speaking together, we have two ministers of our Prime Minister Edi Rama, the Interior Minister Saimir Tahiri, who even welcomed the Mujahideens, and the ex-Minister of Economy Lefter Koka, who are in jail. One of them is for stealing state funds, and the other is for being part of Ndrangheta. So,
I'm sorry, doctor, we have to explain. Ndrangheta is one of the Italian organized crime organizations of southern Italy.
Yeah, so Ndrangheta is one of the most dangerous branches of Italian mafia.
Yes.
So as you can imagine, people from our Prime Minister Edi Rama to even the President as well, there are people who have huge files by the Americans and the American drug agency DEA. So what Americans do with our politicians, they use blackmail in order to force them to do anything that the Americans want. So in the case of Albania, they are using our country as the trash bin of Europe. Mm-hmm. And in particular, they have turned Albania into the most staunch ally of Israel in the Muslim world and one of the greatest enemies of Turkey and Iran. So the bulk of the Mujahideens came to Albania in 2016. And as you rightly mentioned, after coming to Albania, there was mass defection from Rajavi cult. because unlike the Gulenists, who many of them are educated people, but they are brainwashed and they believe that Fethullah Gulen is the Imam Mahdi and they have to obey to him even when he takes actions against Turkey and Islam, the Mujahideens in general, they are ignorant. They are people who, for the past 30 years, they have been abducted or cheated, taken from Iran, and they were kept in deserts in Iraq. Now, many of these people, because I have interviewed many of the defectors, they live in a utopian world. Maryam Rajavi, in their paramilitary camp that they had in Iraq, and they have in Albania now, in the town of Manus, she does not allow her members to communicate with their families, to watch TV, to talk to foreigners via internet, and to possess even smartphones. These people, they are not allowed to marry and to have contact to the outside world.
Exactly.
So these people, the Rajavi cult is a very apocalyptic cult, is probably like Lord's Resistance Army. These people, they have very strange ideas about the world. But now, as you mentioned, is that after coming to Albania in 2016, many of the Rajavis, they came in contact with an open and generally free society, and there were mass defections. And now this was a nightmare for Maryam Rajavi, who rules this cult with threats and lies. She depicts herself to her followers like being a holy woman, and she depicts Masoud Rajavi, who is dead since long time, like being a messenger of God. And many of the members of the cult, they simply ran away. Now, nowadays, in this moment that we are speaking in Albania, there are many members within the Rajavi cult who would like to flee, defect, and live a free life. However, the Albanian government, the U.S. Embassy in Albania, and Rajavi itself, they keep their members close in the camp. They blackmail and threaten them, and they do not let them to.
Excuse me, let me just follow up on this. This is exactly we've come to a good point. So basically what we can then conclude, because of course you are a historian, you teach history at the Islamic University in Malaysia. So let's try to reach a conclusion from this. So basically the Americans at some point in the early 2000s decided that they need an Islamic country to serve as a base to be able to infiltrate, be able to operate within the Muslim world. And Albania seemed to be the best one because it was in Europe. There was a history of the history that you explained. There was what in political science would be called a kleptocracy, a rule of the thieves, which would allow them to infiltrate much easier and influence them much easier than many other countries where the rulers or the leaders might have to answer to the people, actually, in terms of what they do. So what we see now is, as you very nicely pointed out, that the two major countries in West Asia, the two ancient but also the new rising Muslim powers, one Sunni, one Shia, Turkey and Iran, who, according to the former head of the MI6, he said that the future of West Asia is Iran and Turkey, that those countries like Saudi Arabia, which are based on oil, they don't really have a future. But you have two countries which have an ancient history and are capable of actually being strong, powerful countries leading the Muslim Ummah. We have now the Americans setting up shop in Albania, bringing these extremists, these cults, these people who are brainwashed in order to use them against these two countries. So this is very interesting. We also have to note here, this is maybe something that very few people know, the fascist party in Spain, the Vox party in Spain, officially was sponsored by the Rajavi cult, that they received money for their elections. Of course, this was the money that Saudi Arabia was channeling to them, to the fascist party in Spain, but it did it through the Rajavi cult. This is another interesting thing. So we can also say that one of the functions of the Rajavi cult in Europe is to funnel Saudi money to whoever needs to be funneled to without that the public realizing that it's Saudi money. So I want to go back, with your permission, to this idea of a kleptocracy, this idea of the country basically being very closely connected, the government of the country, the leadership, being closely connected to organized crime. Albania is actually a country that produces oil. This is something that very few people know. It actually is an oil-producing country. But from what I was reading in your articles, the Albanian people are not seeing any of that oil. Could you very briefly, because we don't have much time left, very briefly explain to us what happened, what is happening to Albania's oil? Who's getting the profits?
Well, Albania is an oil producing country which doesn't have oil for its people, and we are forced to export oil from outside. Albania produces in a year, I think, around 1 million tons of oil, but all our oil is being taken for zero money in return by an American-Canadian company called Bankers Petroleum, which is headed by the ex-general of NATO who bombed Yugoslavia, Wesley Clark. This company, which takes our oil and gives nothing to Albania in return, is being protected by US government itself. In 2017, because Bankers Petroleum, they use fracking in Albania, they destroyed a town known as Marinza, where they caused a huge explosion because of the fracking they were doing. And in that time, Albania's prosecutor general wanted to open a criminal case against this company, which evades and pays no tax and takes all the oil out of the country. And when the general did this thing, he was blackmailed by a U.S. ambassador in Albania, who now works for the State Department, Donald Liu. And the prosecutor general was removed from his job, and later he was charged for not declaring his properties. So we have almost the same situation like in Ukraine, where Joe Biden and U.S. administration went against the prosecutor general of Ukraine,
exactly,
who wanted to make charges against Biden and a number of American oligarchs. So in Albania, we live in a jungle-like when it comes to U.S. interests. And coming back to the Mujahideens, if I may clarify,
sure,
this, Mujahideens are kept in Albania because Israeli Mossad needs them. They are, in a way, used by Mossad to attack Iran, to create as much as possible enmity and fake news about Iran in Europe. And during the era of the Trump administration, for people who have followed my articles, they even created a number of so-called fake terrorist incidents in Europe where they were blaming Iran. The reason was that the Israeli government is fighting a proxy war with Iran in Europe. That was the time when Iran was still in the nuclear deal, and Israelis played every card they could in order to scare the Europeans. And the attacks of the Mujahideens of or the Munafikins, how you call them, against Iran, culminated in March 2018 when they make a fake claim as if Iran wanted to make a terrorist act in Albania. Me and my colleagues who are journalists, we proved that this was a fake news. But this fake news, which was taken by American medias like Fox News and others, was used as a justification to boot out of Albania the Iranian ambassador.
Exactly.
So coming back to the system in Albania nowadays is, even though in appearance country looks to be European, open and free, the situation is very much similar to what happens in Ukraine under Zelensky, where you have gangs that rule, and in the top of the gangs you have the U.S. embassy.
Doctor, okay, so we had some very heavy issues that we were discussing, and it seems that the present is a little, heavy and depressing. But what I want to ask you is about the future. Are there people in Albania who are more nationalist-minded, who are maybe more willing to implement policies and govern the country in a way that's more in favor of the interests of the Albanian people, that is maybe going in the direction of establishing those links again with the Muslim world, whether it's Turkey or Iran or the Arab countries? How do you see the future? Is there hope for the future?
Albanians were the most pro-American people in Eastern Europe and in Balkans during the last decades. And this was because the Americans helped the Albanians during the Yugoslav conflict with a NATO intervention in 1999 on behalf of Kosovo. However, in the last decade, American policies towards the Albanians have changed a lot, especially during the Trump administration. We have the top leadership of the Albanians, from the president of Kosovo to the head of the parliament, who have been jailed in The Hague with the blessing of the Americans. And also in Albania, the Americans, they are attacking our president and our ex-president and prime minister and head of the opposition. There is an open rebellion against Americanism in Albania in particular, but even in neighboring Kosovo. Even though the situation now seems gloomy, like it is in Ukraine with the Zelenskys that the Americans have installed in power, I think there is hope for Albania. We have to keep in mind that majority of Albanians are Muslim. We are Sunni and we are Shia as well. And the historical connections that Albania had and has with the Muslim Ummah, with Turkey and Iran, cannot be outdone by terrorist groups like the Gulenists and the Munafikins. So there is hope for Albania. And I would like to appeal to the Muslim Ummah not to forget Albania. After all, Albania is the oldest and the only fully recognized Muslim majority country in Europe. We are Europeans, and the presence of Islam in Albania cannot be outdone by the Americans. In the last decade, the Americans are trying to squeeze and destroy the influence of Turkey, Iran, but even of Arab countries in Albania. Nevertheless, they cannot outdo Islam. As we see now, the situation with the defeat of NATO in Ukraine and with the rising of Russia and the end of the unipolar world where only Americans would dictate to the rest of the planet, I think, yes, there is hope for Albania. Albanian Muslims will re-establish their connections with the Muslim Ummah, and they will not allow their country to be used as a base against Islam. The presence of the Gulenists, but even of the Mujahideens, is very much hated in the country. Even the kleptocratic system that the Americans have installed is hated, and I think that the change will come sooner or later.
Dr. Yazici, thank you so much for joining us. This was a very important subject, I think, which, it's like adding insult to injury. All these things happening in Albania, but also the media not covering it. So we were trying to shed light and give some insight to our audience about this very important part of the Muslim world and of Europe, this unique place where Europe and Islam are come together. And thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for giving us insight on this issue.
Thank you for having me.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Dr. Yazici? We learned that Albania is the only Muslim-majority nation in Europe, with approximately 70% of the population declaring their adherence to this religion. This fact is precisely the reason that the U.S., European nations and Israel have been particularly sensitive about Albania establishing close relations with other Muslim nations such as Iran, Turkey, or Saudi Arabia. Following the collapse of communism in the 1990s, there was a concerted effort by the U.S. and its vassals to occupy Albania and the Albanian majority region of Kosovo in order to first strategically deny this Muslim majority nation and region to the Muslim Ummah and Muslim nations such as Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia, with the usual fake excuse of fighting Islamic terrorism. Secondly, to use it as a platform and base for operations against Muslim countries such as Iran, Turkey, and other Arab countries by using a Muslim facade and establishing various terrorist cults and deviant sects who have declared war against the legitimate governments of some Muslim nations in Albania, in a policy that Dr. Yazici called turning Albania into Europe's garbage can. Thirdly, to weaponize legitimate Albanian nationalist feelings against Serbia and Russia, and in this way use Albania and Kosovo as a NATO base against Russia in Eastern Europe. In pursuit of these strategies, the U.S. has bought and captured Albanian elites and has produced what Dr. Yazici has called our own little Zelenskys, in reference to the pro-Western Ukrainian leader elites, who are basically just the executors of policies determined by the U.S. Embassy and the Soros Foundation. As usual, America is its own worst enemy in the countries it tries to control by propping up corrupt leaders who eliminate peaceful political opponents and abuse human rights. And so we see the same pattern in Albania as we have seen in so many other Muslim nations, where the U.S. supports corrupt and abusive elites, which results in turning the people of that nation against anything and anybody that has anything to do with the United States. Just like the atheist communist dictatorship failed over decades to extinguish the light of Islam and the connection of the Albanians with their fellow Muslim brethren of the Ummah, so too is the current U.S.-Israeli strategy to de-Islamize and weaponize Albania for their own strategic goals doomed to failure, because it is contrary to the deep-held religious beliefs and national interests of the Albanian people. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
متاسفانه این اتفاق افتاده تو بعضی از کشورها. شما تو کشورهای غربی که یک فرهنگ مادی.
Unfortunately, in some countries, especially the Western ones, you can see many cases of children who are born through sexual corruption. You can find the exact statistics on the website of IFS or Institute for Family Studies. The rate of illegitimate children in France, for example, is about 56%. This means that out of two children, one is illegitimate. The other Western countries have such conditions too.
این اتفاق رخ داده و شیطان تونسته اون نقشه خودش رو عملی بکنه.
This is a catastrophe for the world. The Satan has been successful in actualizing his plans. He also does his best to create such a dirty culture among the believers of the Muslims. Hopefully, he was not successful in Muslim lands like Iran, and the rate of illegitimate children is very much low. This is because the Muslims are faithful to their families and to their religious beliefs. The only way to oppose corruption, whether financial or sexual, is resistance. And religions, especially Islam, help in this regard very much. Therefore, self-control and patience in corruptions is very much recommended in Islam. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.